Radio Ghana.
Good evening and welcome to Behind the News, our news and current affairs program which examines issues from the perspective of newsmakers and experts. My name is Agatha Samoa. And tonight, political parties' code of conduct, is that enough to ensure decency on our political landscape? How should public documents be handled? Can they be kept at home? And a local government expert reflects on the stalemate regarding the elevation of Aplau to municipal status. Our text line is 0264-418767. 0264-418767. Now to our first story. Who owns state documents? Political leaders or the state? The debate has been ignited by concerns that some officials of the previous administration allegedly took away some documents when they were leaving office. It has become commonplace for some past officials to say that they have all the documents pertaining to issues raised in relation to their tenure. What is the ideal situation? How was it in the past? Ambassador KB Asante is an elder statesman and he has joined us on the line to explore the issue. Good evening, Mr. Asante.
Good evening.
Should past officials keep public documents?
No, public documents are public property. And there are rules and even laws about it. We didn't establish a national archives for nothing. It was the archives, they are to be the repository of all documents. Of course, ministers and officials can and do take documents home to work on them. This is a fact. But the documents are not the property of any minister or official, and they should always be left behind. A new government should leave, the outgoing government should leave all documents, and any civil servant should not keep documents as if it were his own.
Is it then an offense to have public documents when you are out of office?
I'm not sure about the legal position, whether if you, I suppose, since it's government property and you take it home and it can be proved that you had intention to keep it permanently, you are guilty of an offense. But I suppose if it's only just an oversight, that is, perhaps you were having it, you're working on it then when you left office, you forgot. But it is known that from day one, when we became independent, that some ministers or some other officials were in the habit of either keeping documents or even removing pages from documents for some reason. When I left teaching, joined this service at after independence, I discovered this. And some of my people who have been there before me talk about it. And some of them even had a ways and means of saying to it that the documents, what was the documents were kept. We have some still living. F.W. Beecham, from what I hear, is still alive. He has a lot of experience on this, and he had ways and means of frustrating the ministers who wanted to get rid of some documents for some, or take pages away from them for some reason. The late Chris Thurston also had very good stories about this. What he did was this. When the minister asks for a file, he thinks about why the minister wanted the file. And he discovers that there was a controversy where he was more or less persuaded to pen his signature. And he wouldn't like that to be there all the time. So he asked for this file. And when old Chris Thurston thinks and realizes that may be the reason, he submitted the file all right, but he took that particular page away. Now, the minister could not very well come and say, where is this page? Because it would be quite clear that was why he wanted the file. And and then the questions will be asked, what for? So this has been going on for some time. Some deliberately keep away files or documentation for files not good reason. But it is generally not done. And as I said, files are the property of government. And in fact, these documents help us. When you a young man goes to the office, he reads them, he knows what has happened before. And when problems crop up, any well brought up civil servant would like to know what happened in the past. You don't have to go and ask all the women who are there to tell you what happened. The files tell you if there is going to be a football match and stadiums have got to be built and there is no money. If you look carefully, you find there have been occasions when we had, as somebody said, open our mouth too big and we said that we're going to do something. And then we're not prepared, like the football match or OU conference. You've got to build a conference hall. Now, what do you do? No money and the time is short and what do you do? We've had experience of it before. The OU conference, what we did. So when the football problem comes, if you are aware of that, you read the documents, you find what happened, you try to do something similar. And perhaps even improve of what we've done in the past. So documents are very, very important. And we neglect the National Archives, or now is it Pratt or whatever it's called, near the Catholic Cathedral. We ignore it at our peril. It is an institution, office, which should be jealously protected and guarded because it is repository of the wisdom of the past.
Then, Mr. Santi, can there be valid reasons why they want to keep some documents?
Yes. In Nkrumah's time, sometimes they've done something when I was involved in this sort of thing, and they didn't want it to be known that they gave the order. There were times it was when that was the beginning of the rift between civil servants and ministers, and that is why there's so much bad blood lots between ministers and civil servants. Each time a new government comes, they try to sack civil servants. We should know that the facts are simple. Something is done, and the president Nkrumah flares up. The minister will then say that it was a civil servant who did it without consulting him. The civil servant will say the minister has it to be done, and he wrote a minute about it, and the minister sanctioned. That's what it happened a lot. And as I said, that was why people, and Beecham is still alive, I think. I hear somewhere in Kaneshi. I've not been able well enough to go and see him. But there may be others. If you talk, old civil servants will tell you what happened. Old Osam Mills is still alive. Jimmy Pillay is there. They are a bit old, so we shouldn't bother them. But there are some younger ones who can tell you what happened. This is the crux of the matter. The ministers come. They come for short term, and they want to do something quickly and go. The civil servants are there all the time. That was why the head was at first called permanent secretary. And the politicians didn't like it, and they got the name changed to permanent secretary. But the problem still remains that we should know why things were done and how they were done. A civil servant can give the advice to the minister. The minister is not bound to take the advice, but at least it's on record. And he'll give his reason why he didn't take it. So when something crops up, we can know what happened, when we learn from that experience. So it's as simple as that. It started from day one, when we became independent. And we've not been able to solve it. We've got to realize that civil servants have a job to do, which is most important. And the ministers also have a job. They represent the people. And eventually what they want to do should pass. But the civil servant has to be allowed to do his job because he's paid by the state to do precisely that.
Mr. Santi, did you mean they changed the name from permanent secretary to chief director?
No, first principal secretary. He became chief director recently. It was changed in Nkrumah's time from permanent secretary to principal secretary in order to let civil servants feel that the head, that he was not there forever. He wasn't permanent. The idea was that the minister comes and goes, but the secretary is permanent. He's there to advise succeeding ministers. And it created a psychological problem. So it was changed. First, not chief director. Chief director was something the French and others did, and we borrowed it. But it was changed from permanent to principal secretary, and recently chief director, whatever it is.
Briefly, how should public documents be handled considering the oath of secrecy sworn by officials?
They should be handled as appropriate. If it's an oath of secrecy, there is a proper area of handling it. But generally, documents are handled by archives. In fact, I think there was a law or regulation about it, because I used to collect some from Flatsav House. I was very sort of interested because my brother-in-law was an archivist. He died recently. And so we worked together. Well, I always, he looked at the files in the office, those which were not, which were well preserved, he took away. The others were, there's a way of destroying files and keeping those which are of value, and he took those which were of value. There is a law, I think, about it, whereby files of value, great importance, are handled to the government archives department. Now it's PRADA, I think we call it. I wonder whether it's still done, but it should be done.
Is it possible for an entire document of a contract, for instance, to get lost, or for a minister to take away the entire file?
If it's lost, I will have my doubts as to why it got lost. Because a contract, that is a very vital document. And it can put the governor into a very awkward situation. You have negotiated, signed a contract with somebody. The government is liable. The other side has all the facts and figures. You don't have it. Then there is a meeting as to where to go from here, and you don't. It's terrible. So it is. I can't imagine how it can vanish. It is a very important document, and people of my generation, principal secretaries, kept such document jealously until the final act. And after that, it becomes a historical document. It goes to National Archives.
Briefly, what is your take on recent allegations that some documents were spirited away by past officials?
Now, if it's allegation, we should try to find out. I'm sure you will not get to the bottom of it all. But the moment you try to investigate a small committee to find out why they, it will put a fear of God into all officials and politicians that you can't just spirit files away. We shouldn't just talk about it, blame somebody. No. How did they... you say they are lost. Okay, what happened? And there are people who can treat this. If you give an ordinary administrator time, he can be their, consultant, go through it all, or investigator. It need not be a policeman, actually. What happened? When was the last meeting? Who kept it? What happened? And so on. People will talk, and you find out what happened. And in fact, in doing this, you will find procedures which should be stopped now. For as I said, we used to take files home and work on them. Some went to the office in the evening to work on them. Senior officers, I mean, because they say at that time there is less disturbance from telephones and visitors. So the files were kept, were taken home for some good reasons and so on.
All right.
But if someone takes it home and is lost, there's a problem. So when we look at, we may even make a law that said files or certain files should not be taken home. If you want to work on the file, go to the office. We may come to that conclusion after due investigation.
All right.
As to how these files
Thanks
got lost.
For your time.
Yes.
That was Ambassador KB Asante, who is an elder statesman. This is Behind the News. For some time now, the people of Aplao have gone on protest demanding that the area be granted a municipal status. In their last protest about a week ago, the Kete South DCE, Bernard Amable, who received the petition, asked them to exercise restraint while the appropriate authorities look into their concern. Tonight, we seek the view of a local government consultant, what he makes of the agitation by the residents of Aplao, and how he thinks the problem can be addressed. Kobla Deku is an expert in local government with specialization in public finance management. Thanks for joining us, and good evening.
Good evening.
What would you say resulted in the stalemates as far as the creation of Aflawo municipality is concerned?
Well, what we can only say has been a period of lack of communication, because we will recall that as far back as November, when the minister met the press, he announced the creation of 42 districts, including Aplao as a municipality. And then we were jubilating, thinking that, okay, this is our chance. Because for a very long time, we have been yearning for this. And as the minister himself said, developments really come in the trail of the creation of districts. Then all of a sudden, what we heard was that Aplao has been excluded from the list that was being sent to Parliament. And we tried to meet the Minister for Local Government to get some form of explanation, but to no avail. And then what we had to do was to quickly seek redress by petitioning the highest office in the country, the Office of the President. And this was on the 13th of December. Incidentally, the president was outside the country and the petition was received by the vice president, who actually assured us that government was not going to renege on its promise to create a proper municipality, and that government was certainly going to do that. So all this time we have been waiting for any announcement, only to hear that, yes, Aplao has been excluded, and that the number of districts that will be created in the region has been cut from 7 to 5, and that instead they were going to elevate the K2 district assembly to municipal status. And the very moment this thing really came out, at least anxiety rose, that what actually has been happening? If we want our share of development, it must come to the creation of district. And this K2 South District is just too big to be just one district. And so, you know, that has been the issue, and then the chiefs and people, and then the Council of Elders met to say we have to really seek the redress because we do not think it is fair to us. We have been marginalized, and it is an injustice to us. That is our understanding, that then, we have been made against.
Then, Mr. Deku, how best can we handle the public anger being exhibited by residents of Aflao?
Well, the only way we can really, you know, handle this thing is for the government to really come and tell us, give us reasons why they think Aflao does not deserve to become, you know, Aflao area does not deserve to become a municipality or a district. You see, if you look at the various districts that have been created even in the past, if you are looking at meeting the necessary requirements as we have in the forces to the Local Government Act, you find out that most of the municipalities that were created in the past never even met the, you know, the conditions. You know. But I wouldn't say that maybe, you know, that was why you know, they were created. They may have taken some other things into consideration. But if you look at the Aplao area, all the requirements are relevant. When you talk of population, in terms of, you know, that, the 2000 population, you know, gave the whole Volta region a population of 1.6 million. The population figure that was received by the Ghana Statistical Service gave the population to be 2.9 million. So the analysis done by the Statistical Service really showed the population actually rose between that 10-year period by 28.4%, giving an annual increase of 2.8%. Now, if you look at that one in the Volta region, the Aplao area for Keto South population is only second to that of Ho. Now, if Ho is a municipal assembly, and you have an area that consists of about 440 communities, and you just elevate it to a municipality and you say that is enough, it is nowhere near splitting the district into two, where development can really reach every nook and corner of the Keto service. In fact, by analysis that I've even made, Keto South District deserves to be actually split into three. You know, to look at what has been happening in other places. So what has to be done is for government to really come out, to really tell it. Because even in the budget, the government discovered that Aflao has the potential. And that is why it declared Aflao Township as an economic zone. Then you need, you are saying that you have the facilities that can be used to manage a district. So why, you know, are we not given this? Why are we denied this this time around.
Mr. Deku,
you know, we need explanation. We need somebody to tell us why.
Mr. Deku, has the creation of districts not been unduly politicized?
Come again?
Has the creation of districts not been unduly politicized?
No, but you see, one thing is that we have it in the Act, Forces 2, Subsection 1. What are the conditions under which districts are to be created? And in fact, this one takes itself from the Constitution itself. So that's not really time. And when they find out that, yes, I mean, we have to really spread a particular district to bring development projects, they do that. So I do not, see this politicization in this particular district. Maybe, others might be thinking, it's not politics, it's really not politics. It is something that is justified. And come and tell us why you think other areas. The analysis that we have made, the petition that we sent to the Vice President, that he promised that, government was going to go ahead to do this. Now you have created others. Come and tell us what other conditions that others made that APLAO did not meet. And then that is why you have denied APLAO for that.
Then what about the threats by residents?
The threat?
Yes.
Well, if you say that, the residents are, they are venting their spleen in the sense that they feel they want their share, of the national cake. And the only means by which you can get your share of the national cake is to approach government. Unfortunately, government has really came out. Now, if you are not, taking a position as a government, we are taking a stand and not a position. We haven't actually taken a position in that particular respect. The people, want an answer to all this. We know, when districts are really created and when districts are really performing, they generate a lot of employment for the people. We don't want our people to, as soon as they finish the GHS, carry their bathroom standards into a polythene bag and start heading towards Accra looking for a job that is not even there. We believe that the potential should be harnessed, and that is what government is doing. And even if that's what government is doing, we just want to make sure that at least the citizens of APLAO and Badama Taketu South actually derive their bit of the action.
All right, thank you very much. That was Komla Deku, who is an expert in local government with specialization in public finance management. And the Ministry of Local Government and Rural Development sources have attributed a stalemate concerning APLAO municipality to technical nature of the issue. The case is being attended to. This is Behind the News, and these are some of your text messages. It's a shame for Professor Mills' government to be talking about missing files almost 4 years into the administration. And this is from Simon Wali Wali. Nicholas Esidi from Tintinku says, it is a state which keeps public documents because they are kept in the interest of all Ghanaians, but not for any political party's parochial interest. And Alhaji Ibrahim UCC says, why must civil servants sit down unconcerned for politicians to toil with the nation's documents? Please, let's be awake, for politicians will come and go, but civil servants will continue to be still at post. Ghanaians are gradually inching towards December elections, and it is the hope of all that politicians will use language that will promote national cohesion. But do our politicians really bother about the language they use in their political discourse? So how do we deal with politicians who use detestful language? The GDA at a peace symposium suggested that media practitioners black out politicians who use insulting language. Also, the political parties at a workshop organized by the Institute of Economic Affairs in Ebri signed up to a code of conduct which is supposed to regulate their behavior with the political temperature heating up. We find out whether the political parties are lining up to expectation. To help us deal with the issue is the programs officer of the Institute of Economic Affairs, Ernest Chung. Good evening and welcome to our studios.
Good evening, my sister.
We have been under multi-party democracy close to 20 years. Why is it necessary to get the political parties to sign up to a code of conduct?
Good evening to your cherished listeners. The political parties' code of conduct has been in existence since 2000. It was first initiated by the Electoral Commission. And to one of the setbacks of the 2000 code was the fact that it was established to only cover activity during elections. So in 2004, the IEA, under the auspices of the IEA Ghana Political Parties Program, brought together all the registered political parties to review the already existing code, the 2000 code, and for the code to cover activities after, before, during, and after the elections. So in 2004, we had the 2004 Political Parties Code of Conduct that was signed by all the registered political parties in Ghana. However, one of the setbacks of the 2004 code was the fact that it lacks an enforcement body. So in 2008, during the review of the code of conduct, the 2004 code of conduct, the parties agreed for the IEA in collaboration with the Electoral Commission and the National Commission on Civic Education to establish the enforcement body to monitor the operations of the code. So in 2008 code, there was an enforcement body to oversee the operation of the code. However, one of the setbacks of that enforcement body was that it was established late. So before the enforcement body was started, most of the parties have already breached some of the provisions of the code. So in 2000 and last year, in August, the parties met again in Ebri to look at the 2008 code, to also look at the setback in 2008. And one of the key issues that came up is to be able to establish a very effective enforcement body under the current code. So one of the new provisions that was added to the 2008 code was the activities after declaration of results. All the existing code that we have had was just activities during campaign, during the elections, and that's it. But we've also added new provisions that look at activities after declaration of electoral results. This was based on what happened during the 2008 elections, when after declaration of results, you could see people carrying coffins and so many other things, which doesn't speak well for our country. So we've also added new provisions to look at the activities after declaration of results.
So what is contained in this particular code of conduct?
I think that, as I indicated earlier on, this code has been in existence since 2004 and in 2008. And this year, as I indicated, is the new provision that has been added is the activities after the declaration of results. And as you indicated, the provisions in this code look at activities during campaign, activities during elections, and after the declaration of results, as I indicated. And one of the critical things the new code look at the issue of the policies of insult, as you mentioned. And I think it's been something that has generated our political landscape for some time now. And I think everybody has raised issues about it. And it's sad that this thing is still in our system, whereby eminent personalities in our country are religious leaders, even from the presidency, before we raise issue about the policies of insult in our airwaves. So I wouldn't say we are in the early stages yet, and we are yet to go into the peak of our elections, and we are hoping that these issues will be addressed before the 2012 elections.
What actions can be taken against any party or a member of a party who flouts the code?
As I mentioned, one of the issues that came up during the review of the code was the need for a very effective the enforcement mechanism, a very effective enforcement body. And the IEA is currently underway of establishing the enforcement body across the country. Under the current code, the code mandates the IEA and the NCCE to establish the national enforcement body and also establish the regional enforcement body across the 10 regions of our country. The enforcement body is mandated to oversee the operations of the code and monitor breaches of the code. So it's not only to just monitor those who are the parties who are breaching the code and reporting them, but they're also to look at those who are complying by the provisions of the code and also commend them. And under this code, on what the enforcement body is mandated to do is to look at the breaches and receive reports from at the regional levels. And these reports at the day will be looked at by the national enforcement body, and they will issue press statements to in the form of naming and shaming the offending parties. And I don't think any party would like to be tagged as a violent party or parties who does not comply with the laws of our country. And I think every party would like to be seen as complying by the code of conduct. Every party would like to be seen as being given a positive image. And I think to a large extent, the electorates and the media has a role to play in this regard, that we should be able to hold our parties accountable to the code that they themselves have signed on to. And one of the means for them to comply by it is we've been able to hold them accountable. And then we should be able to question them. I think we've seen your party chairman sign on to the code of conduct, and in one of the provisions is for us to not to insult on airways, but we could see your supporter insulting. So what is the party doing about it? And I think it's high time parties should be able to disassociate themselves with certain comments which are made on the airways by their so-called supporters. I think if we are able to see a party issuing a press statement to disassociate themselves from a statement passed on there by a party supporter, it will go a long way to address these issues of insult, because already all the eminent persons we have in our country, all the our religious leaders have spoken a lot about this issue of insult. And attempt has been made. That he has provided several platforms to address this issue of insult. I remember during the celebration of the World Democracy Day, one of the issues we looked at was the policies of insult and how it's affecting our multi-party democracy. And one of the what is most threatening is the fact that is the youth who are engaging in the issue of insult on our airwaves. And the question we should ask ourselves is, why are we taking our democracy to? These are the people in some few years we are going to hand over the leadership mantle onto. And these are the same people who are telling that they are engaged on airways on with issues of insult.
Talking about enforcement, were there no enforcement in the past?
As I indicated, in 2008, the enforcement body was established, and I think it was established late, and before even the body was started its operation, the parties have already breached the code. And there was also there were other issues in terms of technical support and other things regarding the code. So however, this year what we're trying to do is we're trying to set up the code as early as possible, and I think by middle of March this year the enforcement body across the country should have been established.
Hold it there, and let's go to the phone lines and speak to a policy analyst of the NPP, Kweku Kwasi, who is also a signatory to the political party's code of conduct. Thanks for your time. To what extent are you educating your members to abide by the code?
Well, we are. We always have. Indeed, many political parties, and I can speak particularly so for the NPP, do preach the code to our membership. I can understand why the public and the media are doubtful that we ever do this, because if you look at what is happening in the media with personal attacks and insults all over, and not hearing any condemnation from the parent political party, then you begin to think that political parties are just not making the effort to correct their members.
So, Mr. Kwasi, how do you deal with any member of your party who uses inflammatory language on the airwaves?
Well, in-house, there have been many, many occasions when people have used inflammatory or unacceptable language. And in-house, they have been cautioned. They have been advised not to do that because it is not in the interest of our party. It is not part of our strategy. It happens all the time. But you see, we have to appreciate that you are sending people to tell the party, to communicate your messages for this election. oftentimes many of these people are very are less motivated in terms of logistics. You do not find it strategically smart to be rebuking them on air because you demoralize them. I mean, this is the cycle of many political parties, and it is the reason you do not hear the kind of open condemnation you would want to hear. For many party activists, if you said something on air, you can take it. If your leadership called you in-house and told you this kind of language is unacceptable, you would take it differently. If your leadership came out and said, those words uttered by this particular person, we, this party, we are dissociating ourselves. You isolate that person, and the likelihood is that people will feel less motivated to even communicate for the party on legitimate issues. So I'm just mentioning this to explain why you do not hear political parties come out and condemn their members. Going forward, what do we do? I think ultimately the public must signal to political parties that if you go this way, we'll punish you.
But Mr. Kwatin, we are not succeeding with the in-house issue.
Well, but a party will have to count its cost if they want to adopt other strategies for correcting their members. If you're going to come out and condemn, dissociate yourself from people who, for instance, have been working very hard for the party, they have been communicating well, they are provoked on a platform, they use unacceptable language, and you forget about all the good language they have used, you come out and say, this person, we are dissociating ourselves from the comments he made. And what do you expect? That after that, he will now go on air and speak on the legitimate issue.
All right, Mr. Kwatin, let's also talk to the Deputy National Youth Organizer of the NDC, Barbara Asamoah. Thanks for your time, Barbara. Has the NDC started educating its members on this code?
Thank you very much, and good evening to listeners. NDC is taking a very high morale ground, especially during this campaign season. And as a result of that, we have called out for ourselves a code of ethics for our communicators. And it's very, very important that we reflect the character and person of the person we are going to market. And so the NDC is very, very going to be very, very tough on our members who go out and communicate on behalf of the party or government, and will be using insulting language. But you see, the most unfortunate part of the story is that in most cases, people go on air to speak on behalf of your party when they have not been sanctioned to do so. And so it becomes very, very difficult for you to be able to reprimand them when they do such things. But then anytime it comes to our notice that somebody who is noticed to have engaged in any form of insult on the airwaves, I can assure you that the leadership should stay so week, and then the weekend, that is last week, and the people who used in abusive language on the airwaves have been spoken to. Whatever word that you used that was not pleasant, we have called people's attention to it, to refrain from using such languages. We want to encourage our communicators as much as we can, so that at the time we get to the heat of the election, people will refrain from using abusive language.
How do you feel when you hear a member of your party or any politician using abusive language on the airwaves?
Oh, it's not encouraging. I mean, it's not something that we should be encouraging. And that is why I'm very happy that of late, every citizen of the country has become worried about the kind of language that politicians have been using on the airwaves. I think that if we ourselves have not been able to check ourselves in the past, now the population of Ghana is going to help us to do that, because Ghanaians, as it looks now, are going to vote on issues and are going to look out for politicians who trade insults on the airwaves. And so we are very, very happy and encouraged by the fact that people are condemning religious bodies, and even organized groups are condemning the use of abusive language. And I'm sure it will go a long way to check politicians who use abusive language on the airwaves.
Barbara, is there a possibility of the leadership getting together to speak about this?
Yes, I think it will be done in a very the shortest possible time. You know, you were speaking to one of my colleagues earlier, and he was talking about why the code of conduct couldn't really work previously, and the fact that so many other measures, including the expansion of the disciplinary committee, has been put in place this time to check some of these abusive language that is used on the airwaves. And I'm sure that with the coming in of all the political parties and other civil society groups, it should help. And I'm sure maybe by the end of the week or the end of March, we should see the leaders of our political parties coming together on one platform to condemn the use of abusive language on the airwaves.
All right, let's hold it a minute. Let's go back to Kweku Kwarteng. Mr. Kwarteng, is there also a possibility of the leadership of your party getting together to speak about the issue?
Well, we have always been speaking together. I mean, the code of conduct we're discussing now was put together by the leadership of the party. We are all signatories to the conduct. So I do not think coming together is what we are lacking. What we are lacking is that the code itself has mechanisms of sanction. And if you look at it carefully, it is just naming and shaming. That if the committee, the monitoring committee, got a complaint for from a party that considered that they had been treated wrongly by another political party, that you could make this complaint, they would investigate it and they would name and shame the party if it is found that the wrong thing was done. But you see, as political parties, you are in the business of winning votes. And if you get the impression that it is a strategy of your opponent to denigrate a particular candidate, and I say this in respect of our own flag bearer, it would appear to us that there is a deliberate strategy by the NDC to paint him wrongly in order to gain political advantage. So the code is there, all right, but we think that in order to bring the public to appreciate how bad such a strategy could be, we must respond in kind so that the public will now wake up and say, oh, it is not a matter of one side receiving it, keeping quiet, and we all thinking that we could go on like that. I mean, I can appreciate that the NDC may also suggest that oftentimes they also have to respond. I don't take that from them, but I am stating it from the case of the point of view of the NPP. So the way to really fix this is not to wait for the political parties to complain to the monitoring committee created within the political party's code of conduct. It is for the public to join that monitoring committee to do the naming and shaming properly. If a political party realizes that when their opponents use bad language, the entire society came against that opponent, then you have no motivation to respond. But when in the past we have heard many of these things, and you don't get a clear signal from the public that they frown on that, then we have to stand up and prove to the public that if we all decide to go this way, in the end, we all lose out. So I think the burden is on the media, it's on the public, to take strong position against specific cases of insulting language.
Mr. Kwarteng, is an eye for an eye not making the world go blind?
Well, sometimes an eye for an eye would be useful. I mean, in South Africa, when apartheid was using violence to oppress people, a violent response from the oppressed in the end brought the world to understand that we cannot sit down and allow this thing to happen. Sometimes there's a need to respond in a way that will signal to everybody that if the aggressor is not stopped, the victim might respond and we'll all be worse off. And I am happy that because increasingly we are realizing that if you use abusive language at the NPP, for instance, you will get a response. We are happy to see the public now wake up to say insulting language is bad. This is the first time I'm being invited to speak on such a topic. For instance, on this station, it might have happened in the past, but I'm making the point that the response that the NPP have given to these cases of insult has now brought the public to realize that, oh, every party could be insulting, and that if we didn't intervene, it would be bad for this country.
All right, thanks for your time. Mr. Kwaku Kwarteng is a policy analyst of the NPP. Now, Barbara, dealing with political insults, what is the way forward briefly?
Thank you very much. I think that in spite of all this, we should be able to distinguish between character assessments, as the flag bearer of the NPP last Saturday said on the platform, and then insults. And because the NDC is committed to eliminate the bad language on the airways, I can assure you that if we have to respond to anything that seems to be an insult on the character of our flag bearer, we are going to respond to it in a very civil manner for the whole of Ghana to know that NDC is very committed to this cause.
All right, many thanks. That was Barbara Asamoah. Now back to you in the studio. How have they been talking to the media, seeing that some presenters have been encouraging contributors in this direction?
I think to a large extent, the media have also contributed to this issue of insult on our airwaves. I think we don't see or we don't witness insult in our pulpits. It's only on the airwaves that we could hear people throwing insult there and from one party to the other. I think the media, some media personnel, and I should say that they've hide behind freedom of speech, and they themselves also even put more fire or even also promote the issue of insult on our airwaves. And I think the media has a responsibility to ensuring that this issue of insult is address on our airwaves, and I think the regulatory body, the NMC, the GJA, they all have a responsibility to check that media personnel don't promote this insult on our airwaves. I think what we've witnessed for some time now, people hide behind, and I could say that there are certain media personnel who have their own interest, and they hide behind journalism, and they're also promoting sort on our area. So I believe that the media has a critical role, especially at this critical point. We are in an election year, and with experiences from other African countries, the media should be responsible in this regard. I think if the media themselves will check themselves on this issue of insult, we're going to be addressed. For politicians, if they get a platform, they'll do otherwise. But if we are the watchdogs, are the mouthpiece of the people who are there to educate and inform, if we are able to perform our role responsibly, I think this issue of insult to be addressed on our airwaves.
All right. In all this, the media have a critical role to play to bring sanity to the body politic of the country. So what better method should the media employ in dealing with politicians who use insulting language on the airwaves? George Sapon is the Executive Secretary of the National Media Commission. Good evening, Mr. Sapon.
Good evening, my sister.
What does the Media Commission make of the inflammatory language that seems to have taken over the airwaves and the print media?
First of all, the Commission insists on decency in broadcasting and journalism generally. And it is for good reason, because political discourse is most sanitized and useful when voters can hear what candidates stand for and make up their mind about who to vote for in order to advance the development of the nation.
What attempts has the Media Commission made to deal with the issue?
First of all, we need to understand the number of things, but let me talk about what the Commission has done. First, the National Media Commission has developed guidelines on how political journalism should be carried out in this country. And I would encourage all media personnel to familiarize themselves with their guidelines on political journalism. We have also, because local language broadcasting particularly is also gaining a lot of ground in this country, we have developed guidelines on local language broadcasting, which also deal with questions of correct use of language and all. And the Commission also intends to undertake a major monitoring exercise to monitor professional performance of the media, particularly in this election year. But let me also make a point. I think that it is good that everybody is concerned about decency on the airwaves. But I think that we should not raise this to super alarming levels as if the nation is on the brink of breakup or we are going to burn. Political discourse in some sense can get very robust. That in itself should not be a source of panic.
There is this concern that the Media Commission is not pushing enough in calling people to order. How do you respond to this?
Our response is that the Commission has done its best within the constraints that it wears, and that in a democracy, one always needs to balance the requirements for responsible journalism with free expression, and the balancing act is always a very dicey thing. The difficulty with political discourse is that sometimes, because it injures people's feelings, everybody believes those who feel aggrieved always want some stronger response or intervention. Sometimes, if there was any way by which you could whip a journalist or arrest him and jail him or her, the aggrieved party would be happier. Unfortunately, in a democratic system like Ghana, those methods are not available as instruments of sanction.
What constraints? Are they also ineffective?
Pardon me?
What constraints are you talking about? Because they are also not ineffective.
Well, for a media regulatory system, the world over, three things must at all times happen. First, you must have a system for setting the standards. Second, a framework for monitoring and enforcing those standards. And third, a system of sanctions and appeals. Developing these require considerable intellectual reflection, consensus building, and training and sensitization. These demand money, to put it bluntly. The budgetary support that the Commission has received so far over the years have not been able to support this. But even in the teeth of all these constraints, we have done the best that can be done. And that precisely is the reason why repeatedly over the past decade, Ghana has always rated number one in all the major indices on the measurement of free expression and the media development.
Well, some analysts say the Media Commission hasn't legally been empowered to sanction media houses that break the ethics of journalism. As a result, any media house can put anything in the papers or on air for public consumption. Is that the situation?
That is not entirely true, even though some improvement in the legislative framework would help. We have always supported the call for a broadcasting legislation, for example, in this country, which would go a long way in improving the legal regime under which broadcasting is carried out. But even under the current laws as they exist, for most responsible media practitioners, the state of the law is okay.
So, as we inch towards the December election, in what ways can we deal with the politics of insults?
First of all, the Commission intends to do a number of things. I have mentioned to you that the National Media Commission is going to undertake a major media monitoring exercise to monitor performance of all the media in Ghana, possibly the resources allow us, to identify professional deficits and then to develop the requisite interventions. We are also going to take a look at the legislative framework within which the media operate in Ghana to address questions like what you just said, to have a national debate on the nature of media legislation that Ghanaians want to have. We have always insisted that we need to balance the need for responsible journalism with the requirements for free expression. We are also going to undertake training for media practitioners, particularly those who are going to work on election issues. We are going to do sensitization for the political actors about how to use the media responsibly.
All right, thanks for your time. That was the Executive Secretary of the National Media Commission, George Sapo. And also joining us on the line is the President of the GGA, Ransford Tete. So, Mr. Tete, you have suggested that media practitioners blackout politicians who use insulting language. Do you think this will do the trick?
Thank you very much, and good evening to your listeners. The situation has become so alarming that we must have to define ways of trying to address the challenge. And talking about blackout, yes, I mean, The issue is that every politician will want to be heard about his or her policies and programs. So if we offer you the platform and all that, you will want to engage in it. Invectives and insults against the political opponent, then if we take that, we take away that opportunity and your people cannot hear you, then they may decide that they may not vote for you or they don't know about your program. So yes, that may not be the entire solution to the challenge, but perhaps it can help.
So how can we avoid these inflammatory languages on our airwaves and in the print media?
I believe strongly that political party leaders also have a role to play, and they must also begin to name and shame people who speak on their behalf. That the contest for power is not about elections, they are about issues. They are about the challenges that confront us as a nation, and how do we address them? We can only address them when we begin to put before our people the antidotes or the solutions to such problems. So during election time, the people can make informed decisions. I believe strongly that everybody is becoming alarmed just 2 months into the year 2012, which is an election year, and that we all believe that something must be done. And this is the time to start talking about it. I'm happy that these issues have come up quite early in the year, and together we can begin to be fashioning out the solution.
All right. Thanks for your time. That was the GJA President Ransford Tete. Now back to you, René. So how do we deal with the politics of results?
As I indicated earlier on, the IEA is in the process of establishing the National Enforcement Body and the Regional Enforcement Bodies. And I think the moment these bodies start their operations, they'll be able to monitor the code and see that parties don't breach the code, especially with the issues of insult. And I think moving forward, the media should be able to check themselves. They should be able to advise themselves. And I think one of the recommendations that has come up across board is the need for media to use the delay broadcasting equipment. I think that's one of the means to be able to address the issue of insult on our airwaves. And I think it's the Media Commission, at our last workshop that we had, that they all signed onto a communique that they were calling for the media houses to purchase delay equipment. I think the Media Commission should take it up and ensure that these media houses, which are operated, especially these private-owned media houses, should be able to purchase this equipment to be able to edit some of the things that come up on airwaves.
All right. Many thanks for joining me in the studio. That was the program's officer of the Institute of Economic Affairs, Ernest Chum. And these are some of your text messages. Is the NDC trying to use the case of missing documents to score points for election 2012? God is watching. And that's from Abuadi in Mankangri. Alhaji Ibrahim UCC says, please, civil servants, let the fear of God be our watchword to save this nation. The NPP is using the Woyomess saga to divert the attention of Ghanaians from the good work of President Mills. God save us from the NPP. And that's from Alhaji Masoud Begro. Politicians must say what they can do rather than accusing what somebody has already done. And that's from Aleke Kumase. So who will African leaders change, taking files that belong to 24 million people? No wonder the whites radical. Us from Edudensi Eric Wamanafu BA. And very soon NDC will accuse NDC of stealing the air we breathe. Propaganda has come to its end. And that's from Karim Paga. This is Behind the News, and that's all for tonight. My producers have been Kinsley Obintre, Christopher Esiedu, Phyllis Kofi, and Bryce Agama. And my technical production was by Joseph Darko. My name is Agatha Sama, and thanks for staying tuned.